Hello and welcome to the Eating Disorder Therapist podcast. This is a podcast to help you find peace with food and overcome disordered eating. And I'm Harriet Frew, aka the Eating Disorder Therapist. And I'm so excited to share with you all kinds of stories, tips, information and guest interviews to help you on your journey in finding peace with food. So thank you so much for listening today. Now, today I'm talking to Victoria Kleinsman, who has been a guest on the podcast before. Victoria is a Brit living her best life in the Netherlands. Victoria is a food freedom and body love coach, inspirational speaker, podcast host and writer. And she is certified in psychology, spirituality and the science of nutrition and is also inspired greatly in her work by her personal experience and walking a tumultuous recovery journey herself. Victoria has overcome anorexia, binge eating disorder, bulimia and an abusive relationship. She struggled for over 20 years with poor body image and disordered eating. But today, Victoria eats whatever she wants, when she wants, and any amount that she wants. She makes food choices from a place of nourishment and pleasure. She is healthy, confident, and knows her worth, and her self-love is overflowing from within. And she has, as she describes, oodles to give others. Now, this episode has already been released on Victoria's Body Love Binge podcast back in February 2024. As it was a joint episode, Victoria and I decided to share on both our podcasts. In this episode, we talk about our own healing journeys and how we have navigated through these. We talk about why people don't feel good enough and the roots of this in experiences and trauma. We talk about suppressed feelings and how eating disorder behaviors help us cope and keep us trapped, with lots of personal sharing. And we share the contrast and complexities on the healing road from our different perspectives and how we are both living happier and more fulfilled lives today. This is truly inspiring and an uplifting conversation to provide hope for what is possible in recovery. I hope that you enjoy it. Let's get to the conversation. Time for a short advertisement break. On the outside, you have it all together. You're successful. You seem happy. But what your friends and family don't see is that you're living in the vicious cycle of bulimia. You know that something needs to change. Your health depends on it, but you just don't know where to start or how to move forward. That's where Conquering Bulimia comes in. It's a one-of-a-kind online recovery course brought to you by certified eating disorder coaches Sarah Lee and Merritt Elizabeth. They know exactly what you're going through. They've both recovered from bulimia and have teamed up with leading experts to create an online course with over 70 videos as a powerful addition to your recovery. Conquering Bulimia is private and self-paced, filled with personal stories and coaching tips that will teach you how to change your behaviors for good. It will challenge and inspire you, and it's affordable, offered at an incredible discount of over 60% of the cost of one-on-one coaching. Break free from bulimia on your terms and start living the life of peace you deserve at conqueringbulimia.com.
So, Harriet, I reached out to you again to make this happen, and thankfully you said yes. I think it's really good to have a conversation around perhaps why eating disorders happen, our experience, little t traumas, like you suggested, that perhaps people don't know a trauma. So shall we dive into why people don't feel good enough in general, do you think, and then like tie it all into eating disorders?
Yeah, let's do it. Shall I just talk a little bit about perhaps why people might not feel good enough then and explore the different reasons? As we're born in the world as a little baby, when you come into the world, you feel good enough, I think, don't you? You expect your needs to be met. You cry when you need something. And hopefully your caregivers can be very responsive and be attuned to you and give you what you need. But I think very quickly, as we grow up and we're in society and we're within our families, we learn in a way, don't we, that to be loved often, it means meeting certain conditions. It means being the good child or good at school or not arguing with your siblings or not being too loud. Or so I guess there's multiple ways in a way where we can get the message back that perhaps there's something wrong with me or I need to change myself to kind of gain the acceptance of people around me. And I think we have like multiple things that influence us, isn't it? It's not just family. And obviously our family of origin is very important. But as soon as we're going to nursery or we're going to school, or there's multiple influences, I guess, that influence how we feel. And yeah, I think from very early on, it's not often a conscious thing, but we start to feel there's something wrong with me, maybe I'm not good enough, comparing ourselves to others. I think it often starts, I think back to my journey, just even remembering quite early on, sometimes not feeling good enough. But yeah, I don't know if you want to like add to that really.
Yeah, I completely agree. It always starts younger, it always starts as a child. And I didn't understand that fully until a couple of years ago. I really started to dive into really the root of everything, because I originally thought it was I just wanted to be smaller and to be skinnier, which did give more acceptance in my environment. But as I've started to dive in more within myself and my own healing, and as well as learning and getting coaches that are really highly educated in this stuff, I understand, like you've said, it does start right from when we're a baby. And I guess it's also human nature as we grow to compare, because when we were living in tribes, if we weren't accepted as part of the group and we got rejected, that could literally be a matter of life or death.
Yeah, no, absolutely. Like devastating. Like, yeah, you would die, wouldn't you? If you were eliminated from the tribe, you'd be out in the cold, rejected. Yeah, it would be pretty bad.
Now we do it on social media. We're obviously not going to be rejected from a tribe because we live in completely different circumstances now, but trying to be good enough, trying to fit in, when society, in my opinion, creates a problem, creates a solution to a problem, and then sells us the solution to fix a problem that they've created. An example, cellulite cream. If cellulite wasn't a problem, we wouldn't need cellulite cream to fix the, in quotes, problem of cellulite. It's just really interesting. It starts from childhood, but then, of course, the world we live in general, it just mirrors back to us. It tells us, first of all, that we're not good enough. And it keeps reminding us that if we buy this, do this, act differently, get a photo app, have all these filters, then at least we will feel good enough, when the joke is we're already good enough as we are.
Yeah, no, it's so true, isn't it? The society we live in just absolutely feeds us back those messages. And I think people fixate on different things, don't they? It might be your academic thing. It might be how you look. It might be what number you are on the scales. It might be how unwrinkly you are. I don't know. There's multiple ways, aren't there, to judge ourselves.
And it's interesting what you've just said has reflected back to me something that I realized only a few years ago. For example, my story, it wasn't said in a nasty way, but I was the dumb blonde. I was the pretty blonde, but the thick one. Like, blonde jokes were made to me all the time by my dad and my family. And it was, they said it in a harmless way. But as a young girl growing up, I got conditioned to just believe that I'm pretty, so that my value was to be pretty and to be slim and to be attractive, so that one day a man can take care of me, as long as I look a certain way. Because I didn't think I was smart, I overcompensated with the beauty side of things, because at the root, I had this big fear of not being good enough, which is, I think, 100% of people's fear when we start to really dive in. So I overcompensated the beauty side of things. And I've seen this in clients, not always, but it's either one or the other. They either try and overcompensate the beauty and the aesthetic side, or if they were told like they're really smart and like massively praised for getting good grades, they will really focus on being perfect and getting the best grades. It's like when we're mirrored back to us that we're perhaps lacking in one area, we overcompensate in another area. Did you experience that in your life, Harriet?
Yeah, well, I think it's quite interesting. I think my experience in some ways was similar, in some ways was different. When I was growing up, in some ways I was quite protected in a helpful way. I look back now and I was almost like really quite innocent, and I was very body neutral, very appearance neutral, really, I think, until I was probably about 16, 17. But it was a lot about not being good enough in terms of, I mean, I was quite academic at school, but my family didn't value that. My dad, he would actually say to me, you know, I brought you up to work on the farm and take on the farm from me and do your duty. And this was very much his dream for me, I guess. And he'd been very much pushed into that himself. Never had the chance really, perhaps, to really do the work, reflect on things, recognize how conditioned he was. So he just kind of repeated the whole pattern with me, really. It's really interesting. In a way, I was getting kind of like validation and acceptance at school for being kind of okay. I wasn't like massively clever, but I felt good enough at school and stuff. But I guess that just didn't match what my dad kind of wanted and those expectations. So yeah, so it's kind of interesting really. So I'm trying to be the really good girl for my dad almost and go along with that. But it was so incongruent from my heart. So I got myself in such a dilemma and such a conflict with it all.
Yeah, I think what you've said brings up two words, connection and authenticity. And as children, I think as humans, actually, but it starts from childhood, obviously, we deeply crave connection and being our authentic selves, don't we? So obviously we need connection more so than being our authentic selves for survival as a child. If we're not feeling or actually being connected to our caregivers as we're our authentic selves, we start to put masks on, not show up as who we are, start to people please, start to do anything we can to get our needs met and feel that connection that we deeply desire. But then often the connection turns into attachment because it's not true, meaningful connection, because our parents probably weren't taught how to actually be deeply and meaningfully connected. And like you said with your dad, it's interesting that of course is what we do until we're aware of it, repeat the pattern that he got given as a child onto you. And because you're a cycle breaker, if you weren't, you would have just repeated the same patterns again to your children. So I think we just crave connection and being our authentic selves, but I've never met anybody who's had both of those without having to go through stuff first. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, no, it's so interesting, isn't it? Kind of looking back, because I think as well for me, I mean, I think we all crave to be our authentic selves, don't we? Yeah. Every human being has that desire and need. But I think I realized for myself, that's almost like one of my absolute number one values. So when I have to squash that down, I am just in like a rage, really. I mean, I wouldn't be showing that to the world. I'd be still very kind of people pleasing the good girl. But inwardly, I was literally this volcano that was about to explode.
I resonate so much. And I'm curious, because without going in, this isn't a human design podcast, but Harriet and I, if anyone has heard of human design, are both manifestors. And our opposite self theme, which basically means when we're not being our authentic selves, we feel that rage within. And when I was a child, I remember feeling so angry, and also I was ridiculed in the anger. So for example, this many examples of this, we were all sat on a Sunday afternoon in the living room, my mom, my dad, before they divorced, my sister, I would be quote bored. And I say bored in quotes because I believe that boredom is a cover up for a true, deeper, more painful feeling. So I used to be bored a lot as a child. So we'd all sit there and I'd be like, I'm bored, I'm bored. They would almost like, well, what shall we do? It would be all my decision to try and come up with something. And then when I couldn't, they would start to laugh when I'd get really angry and frustrated. In this deep, heated, like rage, I was just ridiculed and just laughed at. And I remember then actually physically crying because I was so overwhelmed and did not know how to feel, and I was being ridiculed in my deep feelings. That was such a common experience for me. Then as I went into therapy and as I truly started to recover from the eating disorder, my coach and therapist were like, there's a lot of rage within you. And I was like, no, I'm never angry. I completely unattached myself from any anger within because I just rejected that part of myself so much. And now I'm very healthy with expressing my emotions. I do sometimes feel deeply angry from a past memory, and I express it and just allow it now. So I'm curious if you were angry as a child and if you were able to be held in that anger, or if you were ridiculed too.
I resonate a lot with what you were saying. I think definitely was ridiculed, humiliated, shamed a lot for just expressing my true self, I think, let alone if it was anger. I very much felt I had a role in the family to be the kind of good, pleasing girl. I think as well in British culture, and maybe this extends beyond British culture, but I think as well, back in the day, it was kind of very normalized as well, wasn't it? It doesn't make it right, but to laugh at people a lot. And I think as British people, we are quite sarcastic. And I think there's really nice qualities to the kind of British humor. But I think it does verge sometimes into quite a toxic place. What's so interesting, actually, is when I was doing my counselling training, my tutor called me up, actually, on my expression of anger, but in a very indirect way. And it was like one of the most difficult parts of my healing, but also one of the most useful. She said to me, like, I was, went into this like meeting thinking, oh, I'm going to get some nice feedback, good girl and everything.
Oh, interesting. Yeah.
Yeah. And I'd had like this really good rapport with this tutor as well. And she said to me, Harry, I want to talk to you about your aggressive humor. And I was a bit like, oh, you know, that was like a punch in the chest because I was so disconnected. I was actually quite angry with this tutor about certain things and I wasn't expressing it directly, but I was kind of using humor and it was quite subtle. It wasn't to the extent that it'd been with my family dynamics and my family dynamics, but she really picked me up on it. And that was a real kind of turning point for me as well, in terms of realizing, actually, Harriet, you're not expressing your feelings openly. And actually, you're repeating old patterns here. You're kind of using humor in a ha-ha way. But actually, the tutor's not funny. The tutor's saying, actually, some of the things that you've been saying, actually, I felt, oh, that doesn't feel good. But that was massive learning for me, because at the time I literally like burst into tears and was devastated and then like ranted to the whole course about how terrible the tutor was.
That's funny. But you were then weren't able to reflect and learn from it then.
Yeah, definitely. Definitely. But I think that was just such a pattern I was stuck in. I was so like the kind of pleasing good girl who kind of gets on with everyone and everyone likes, but I didn't express a whole other side of me in a really unhelpful way. And it was leaking out with the tutor, but I think as well leaking out into, I'd be a bit passive aggressive or being a bit stroppy. I wouldn't say directly, but also feeling no permission to have that anger. Yeah. I don't know if you relate to that, but just in a way, feeling very guilty for having that emotion is quite a block to processing it and then dealing with it in a healthy way.
Yeah, that is so interesting, isn't it? Because there's a difference between anger and like dangerous rage. Because anger, it's fed back to us that it's not okay and it's dangerous or it's not healthy. But that's not true, because anger felt and expressed in the right way can be so empowering and can create massive change. In fact, thinking back, as just as I'm speaking out loud, I think anger was one of the things that got me to full recovery, because you may have heard me say time and time again, one of my mantras was, and I have to swear because it brings the anger passion, whatever it fucking takes. I was so almost angry, not necessarily at myself, but at the life I was living, constantly starving and then the binging and the hating my body. I was so done with it. And I was so angry that I was there, because I was also a perfectionist and I won everything I did. And if I did something, I did it the best. That kind of characteristics helped to get me through to recovery, because I was like, right. It was that kind of anger determination of like, I'm going to change this now and it's going to be hard. And I also don't care, because I'm used to fighting. I was used to fighting and just keeping going and going and going. And again, everything that helps you to create the eating disorder in the first place is everything you need to get you out of it. And then I started to change my values of like, okay, maybe determination and resilience is not my top values anymore. It's love and acceptance and abundance. So what do you think? And we'll go into, I think, next into little t trauma, like complex emotional trauma, which is what people aren't necessarily aware of. But before we do, Harriet, what characteristics do you think got you into the, not was the cause, obviously, but that created the eating disorder for you? And were they the ones that got you out of it when you chose to recover?
Yeah, no, interesting. What got me into it was so much about just wanting to be accepted, people pleasing, being very passive, losing touch with myself. I was really going down that path. And it's interesting, the difference that I experienced perhaps when I'm hearing you talking about your eating disorder is I wasn't ever really a perfectionist. I'm not really. I definitely am quite driven and probably quite competitive about some things, but I'm not a perfectionist at all, actually. And then the way that kind of saved me in a way, because if I was never someone who was counting calories or fixated too much on the scales, I was very much kind of valuing being thinner, but it was in a much more global kind of non-specific way, which is really interesting, isn't it? So I guess what got me into it as well, trying to get back to your question, it was a lot of the suppression of anger, feelings, my authentic self. And I guess when I turned that on its head Absolutely. I mean, the anger for me was a massive positive fuel to realize, actually, I want more for my life than this. It gave me such a big, always had like a lot of hope. And I had a lot of belief somewhere in myself that although I simultaneously felt completely not good enough and worthless and a mess and like unlovable and all over the place, and I knew that I was going to recover and I knew that I was going to help people, I much had a very strong thread even amongst all the chaos. So it's interesting, isn't it?
Yeah. I'm reflecting back as you're speaking and I'm curious if I had that. I don't know if I had that knowing. I just looked back on my life. I was kind of coaching myself without realizing it. If you look back on your life, and this is, I guess, to everybody to support them perhaps to take in that first step, where you are now and where I was, I had made that happen. In life, if we take full responsibility, not blame, because of course we're going to go into childhood stuff shortly, but I have been at cause of everything that's happened in my life, going back to everything I quote used to win whenever I would put my mind to something, I knew I could get stuff done because I've got proof throughout my life that if I want something, I will work it out somehow. If I want it enough, if I didn't want it enough, I wouldn't even bother, because not now, but I was either doing it and winning and being the best at it, or I just wasn't even bothering because I didn't want to be average, because that was the biggest insult of all, to be average. Now I'm happy to just be in the middle and be in the gray area. So I looked back and was like, right, I've got evidence that I've done this, this, and this in my life. I don't 100% know if I can recover, but I tell you what, I'm going to give it all that I've got. Because then at least if I've given it all that I've got and then I quote fail, at least I can then go back to restricting and be perfect at restricting. But I didn't want that anymore. So I just gave it everything. So I think there's that shift that needs to happen within. Have you read Liffey's book, Rainbow Girl?
Yeah, I've got it here, but I've only read the back so far.
Oh, okay. When you do read that, and I've finished reading it recently, the pattern I saw in Liffey's life was she'd been put through treatment after treatment after treatment. She didn't actually want to recover, which is why the treatment didn't work. But towards the three quarters way through the book, it was so interesting. I don't want to ruin it too much for you, but someone said to her, you will never recover. You just got to live with the eating disorder. And she rebelled. So that was the best thing that could happen to her. And you and I are both natural rebellions being manifestors. Someone told her she couldn't do it. And then from that moment, she decided to recover and prove that she could. And she did.
Yeah, incredible.
Isn't it interesting? So there's something that's got to happen within where you want it enough to go through the emotional turmoil and the physical turmoil to recover. Isn't there?
Yeah, it's so true, actually. And it's so interesting reflecting on your story, because it sounds like for you, maybe just in terms of more how your personality is in a way, like I think you were probably a lot more self-aware and reflective when you were in your recovery. And it sounds like you got very focused and very determined. Whereas for me, it was a bit more like, and it makes a lot of sense thinking about it, I'm a bit more of an intuitive, feely kind of person. So I wasn't so much specific about it at all. It was more like a knowing, a feeling, an intuition that led me. But in a way, we were walking similar paths, but perhaps driven by how we were interpreting it and making sense of it in different ways.
Yeah, I love that, Harriet. I would love to get into all the little T trauma and the word abuse, because when I was going through my recovery, and this has only all happened in the last 2 years when I've really started to educate myself and truly understand what all this emotional trauma stuff is that professionals were talking about that causes the eating disorder. When I used to hear the word abuse and trauma, I automatically thought if someone was abused as a child, it would mean sexual child abuse, physical abuse. If I heard the word abandonment or neglect, I would assume it would be locking your child in a room and not feeding them. But actually, the more I've delved into this and understood how this has played out in my life, I understand that me being my mum's best friend is not healthy. As an adult, that's fair enough. Like, you're both adults, you've gone your separate ways. But as a child, being your mum's best friend, and this was my experience, being completely enmeshed with my mum. And when I was crying, she would say things like, oh, don't cry, you make me sad when you cry. And I want to say that I'm not blaming my mum. My mum and dad loved and love me with all that they have and know how. to love. They love me with all that they have and all that they are. But my mum was actually abusing me, and she didn't realize it, because enmeshment is abuse, because it's using the child to make her feel better. For example, when she wanted a hug from me because I was upset, she wasn't hugging me because I was upset necessarily. It was because she was so upset because I was upset. Hugging me would also make her feel better. And there's so much I can say about this. She used to say all the time, and again, she didn't know she was doing this to harm me in any way. Oh, we're so alike. You're so like me. You're like a mini me. Obviously, then I would just copy everything she did, which is when I started my first diet. She was the biggest people pleaser I've ever met in my entire life. So, of course, I also learned how to be the best, most perfect people pleaser. And I was being, like you said, you were so far away from your authentic, true self. I was getting further and further away from who I was. And then the anorexia that came for me, it started off, because everyone has a different story as to what led into that. For me, it started off with me wanting just to be thinner, because my mom, I noticed as a child, this is like all internalizing it myself. Oh, when there's someone who is in a large body walking down the street, my mom always has to comment on their large body. And then when someone's pretty and beautiful and thin, she always comments and she's liking that. And my child brain was, if I'm as thin and as pretty as possible, I'm going to get even more love and validation from my mom. I started off just wanting to be thinner. And then because I have the genetics for the migration response, and I was at a certain weight that switched on, all of a sudden, I wasn't hungry ever. Food brought me no joy whatsoever. I wanted to move. Don't eat. And then all of a sudden, I'm in the doctor's office with my mom, and I'm sat there, you know, as completely trying to be as small as physically and emotionally as possible. And the doctor hands me a leaflet with the words anorexia over it. And even now, like, my heart is still, I can't describe the feeling when, and I don't know why I'm getting emotional right now, the leaflet that I saw, and then my mom and the doctor just staring at me, and I was in denial, and I was like, no, I'm fine. And I was in such denial that there was something wrong with me, because then I was hurting my mom. And when I was hurting my mom, it was like my heart was physically breaking. And a child shouldn't feel that. It was so enmeshed. It was like I was the parent. I'll stop there because I can keep going, but I'd love to hear yours, but I don't think it was enmeshment. Yours was something different, right? What was the biggest kind of catalyst for your start of the eating disorder?
Time for a short advertisement break. I know that we talk about strategies to overcome eating disorders and find food freedom on this podcast, and I've often shared my story to let you know that you're not alone in the struggle, and that yes, you can recover from eating disorders completely. Now, one of my friends, Dr. Marianne Miller, has a podcast that covers similar topics. It's called Dr. Marianne Land, an eating disorder recovery podcast, and I've guested on it twice, and I'm lined up for a third time in the coming weeks. Dr. Marianne also had an eating disorder for nearly 25 years, and she went through atypical anorexia, exercise bulimia, and binge eating disorder. She really has a unique voice that speaks not only to people in recovery, but also to individuals in larger bodies. Listening to her podcast will help you find mental clarity and deep-rooted healing that comes from her knowledge as an eating disorder therapist and binge eating coach. Subscribe to Dr. Marianne Land, an eating disorder recovery podcast, on Apple, Spotify, and other platforms. Check out the link in the show notes, including the links to one of my guest episodes.
Well, it's so interesting, because I think just hearing what you're saying, in a way, like, you really loved your mum so much, didn't you? And then in a way you became very responsible as the child for taking care of her emotions, being like the golden girl in a way that was going to make her feel good. And then you kind of get that feedback back. I guess, like, with my situation, it wasn't so different in some respects, because I think for my dad, in a way, I really did love my dad beneath all the layers, although it may have not been so apparent on the surface, particularly when I was a teenager. But in a way, I guess his message to me, in a way, was very much to not let me down, to please me, to make me happy, to make me okay. You've got to do this. And I guess I could sense with my dad, in a way, like, although he was outwardly perhaps quite an angry, assertive, confident person, there was a lot of vulnerability. And I guess as a child, I recognized, I wouldn't have been able to put it into words, but I recognized actually underneath all these layers, my dad was very sad, struggling person. And that's just the awful, isn't it? As a child, probably how you felt with your mum. You want your parent to be okay. It's devastating, isn't it? To think, oh my God, my parent's really struggling. And in a way, if I am my authentic self, again, you can't really put this into words as a child, but I realized by me being authentic, I was like really disappointing him, letting him down, making him really sad. And I guess I could sense already as a child that he was really, really struggling. There's some sort of overlap, isn't there? Yeah. There's similar kind of sharing of experience there, although it was presented in slightly different ways. And I think with my mum as well, I mean, my mum is just the most loving human being ever. She's so unconditional. I've really internalized that. And I think it enables me to do the job I do today because of she was so loving. But she couldn't cope with emotions. I remember going to talk to her about having bulimia and she just cried and she didn't know what to do. And then again, I was just kind of like, oh no, I've really upset my mum. This is too much for her. It's a burden. She doesn't know what to do. So just feeling
your fault in a way.
Yeah, definitely. So feeling very emotionally alone, I guess, even though being loved. And I'm just thinking as well, maybe that leads us a bit into the kind of smaller T traumas in a way. Whereas I think people will often say in therapy, won't they? Well, nothing major happened to me. Like you were saying, you often think of like severe abuse or being like locked in a room or something and not fed. And sadly, some people listening or watching this may have had that. And that's just devastating. But for many of us, it's just maybe that we haven't had a parent that's been in a good place with their mental well-being, where they can show up, be attuned to us, be like that kind of safe container to hold our emotions, where we feel in a way we can just show up and be ourselves and it's okay. And then that comes out, doesn't it? You might have a parent that says every time you cry, oh, you know, don't be silly, just have a chocolate biscuit or think of something positive. Just maybe trying to fix it. Oh, you know, if you're upset, why don't you just do this? This is what helped me. Not really listening or being attuned. And I think another way it shows up is where maybe the family is just very chaotic. Maybe a grandparent dies, or maybe there's a sibling in the family that has a lot of needs. Maybe they've got learning difficulties and they need a lot of attention and a lot of appointments. So the parents are really focused on looking after that sibling as they would be, as any caring parent would be. But then it can leave maybe other people in the family just not getting their emotional needs met. You just have to kind of get on with it a lot more. And I think as a child, you won't really have the language or realize what's wrong. You'll kind of just realize something doesn't feel quite right. I don't feel completely at home in myself. I feel like I'm a bit of a burden or I'm too much. But you won't really understand that actually it's because my mum's really stressed and she's dealing with my sister or my grandma's just died. And you'll just know that it all just feels too much and you won't feel safe in your body.
And you try and cope.
Yeah.
Try and cope with it, because as humans, we're problem-solving machines. So like you said so beautifully, Harriet, everything you've explained is spot on. And also as a child, we don't know these words. We don't even know that this is going on. It's just a feeling and an experience that we have. So we try to cope with it. So in a way, an eating disorder is a warped way of trying to take care of self when you're coping with a feeling that you don't understand. Also, exactly speaking to what you said, parents that don't even know how to feel their own feelings because they've not been taught, how can they hold us in our big feelings? Because when we, and I wrote this down actually, something like when we're alone as a child in our big feelings, not physically alone, emotionally alone, when the parent doesn't know how to deal with the sadness or the immense anger or even the immense excitement that a child might have, then as a child, you can feel very alone in those emotions, feel very overwhelmed, and then just try and cope. The anorexia, again, was because I wanted to be thin, but there was a part of it of like, I can control my little environment. So my grandma had died. My mum was extremely upset, again, because of the enmeshment. Seeing my mum was upset, it was like, oh my God, how can I fix her being happy? I can't. I'm just going to just try and do something and control something. My dad was physically there, but emotionally unavailable, and still is to some degree. I love him to bits and he loves me as much as he knows how. He had a very challenging childhood back when he was growing up. So he was kind of emotionally not there at all. So the eating disorder was quite a comfort in a way. It was my little world to focus on numbers, to focus on weight, to focus on things that kept me busy, other than actually feeling and experiencing the trauma of what my life was at that point. And then it just spirals down though. And then before you know it, you've got people saying to you, you're literally going to die. If you don't eat, you're actually going to die. And then my mum was then taking antidepressants and she was having breakdowns. And I think honestly, in a way, the enmeshment that I had with my mum started my recovery from anorexia, because it wasn't necessarily for me. It was, I can't do this to my mum anymore because she can't cope. So in a way, again, the enmeshment wasn't a great thing, but it was exactly what got me out of the anorexia, which then did lead into bulimia and binge eating. That's another story in a way. How did you start to recover from your bulimia? Was it a choice or just an intuitive, natural kind of steps?
Yeah, I mean, it was a choice. It's interesting for me. I had a very brief phase of being an anorexia nervosa, literally probably about 3 or 4 months, actually. So I very quickly went into bulimia. And then everyone around me, in some respects, then thought I was fine, which was like pros and cons of that, I guess. In a way, it kind of got everyone off my back. But interestingly for me, again, I really knew I was going to recover. Probably like had 2 or 3 years of absolute chaos and eating disorder. And then I was quite determined to recover. Initially, I was doing it more through kind of willpower. Then I started having some therapy. It was a messy old, bumpy old road, but something within me just knew that this wasn't going to be my life. I don't know where that came from, because as I said before, simultaneously, I felt just hopeless and unlovable and unworthy and everything as well. But I think, again, for me, like talking about the enmeshment, one thing that really helped me is I went to Australia when I was 23, and that for the first time gave me physical distance from my family. I was able to actually think for myself without all these kind of voices and opinions. I then wrote a letter to my mum and my dad, actually, and just expressed a lot of how I felt about things. I was hoping for the perfect letter back where everyone apologizes, and it didn't happen, actually, but it was very, very helpful, because my dad actually wrote back to me. I could tell from that letter that he did really love me, but also some of the things he said in the letter, something, the penny dropped for me, and I just realized this actually isn't about me. It's about how he's looking at the world.
Yeah, as with everybody.
As with everybody, yeah. But that was a major catapulting step forward. It wasn't like, oh, I wrote the letters and off I went into the sunset. Mm-hmm. I was still struggling for a few more. I suppose it's almost like part of the kind of healing journey. It is really important, isn't it? I think as and when you're ready to go there, to get in touch with perhaps the ways that you didn't get your needs met in childhood, and being able to kind of go there. And that is painful and difficult, and it will bring up rage and distress and upset. And sometimes it feels a lot worse shorter term before it feels better. But we can't shortcut that, can we? You can't jump into a place of peace and compassion for all and love and acceptance. You have to kind of go through that. And I don't know if you do relate to that as well.
So much, because when I said I started recovering from the anorexia, I developed anorexia in the age of around 11, 12. And I would say at the age from about 17, I was weight restored enough to not have the anorexia genetic switched on, which meant, again, I could enjoy food. I wanted food. But because I'd only addressed the actual physical symptoms of the eating disorder, and I was just eating with structure, then that's why it turned into bulimia and binge eating, because I hadn't actually addressed the root of everything. So it wasn't until, interesting, you said you went away and you created physical distance, because when I was 30, which I can't believe was only 6 years ago, I moved to the Netherlands to be with my now husband. I physically moved, even though I didn't live with my mum, I was always close to her, like literally 2 minutes down the road, or like totally seeing her every day. I physically had to leave my environment without knowing I had to, but this was my path to start my true healing and get to the absolute root cause of why this all happened in the first place. Because with mental health and with mental health support, obviously when our parents were children and then when their parents were children, it wasn't talked about or it wasn't supported. So for instance, my grandma, who would look after me and my sister 5 days a week because my parents both work full time, my grandma had severe mental health issues. And if I cried as a two-year-old, she would just lock me outside till I stopped crying and she would let me back in again. And that was laughed at in our family because it was just seen as funny for some reason. I thought that was funny too, until a couple of years ago when my therapist was like, that's extreme abuse. And I'm like, no, it was fine. It was funny. I didn't stop crying. I was a problem child, so they just locked me outside. But that's not okay. So we deflect with humor as well a lot when there's a deeper pain underneath. Going back to me moving away, I had to physically leave the environment that I'd brought up in, like you said, with all the noise and all the opinions and the family dynamics that when you do get together, I was automatically like a child again, in a way. I started my true healing journey. And the biggest thing that came up for me, first of all, I remember saying to she's now my coach, actually, I was talking about my childhood and I was saying things like, oh my God, that's so fucked up. And she said to me, if that wasn't fucked up, what would it be? And I was like, it's sad. And then I was like, I was trying to deflect again with like humor. And then when I allowed myself to go there, Harry, I was heartbroken. My whole world, the fantasy childhood I thought I'd had, was just destroyed. And then I had to grieve that. But then I also had to grieve the childhood I should have had with my needs that should have been met. I mean, the word should is a bit disempowering because they were doing the best they could. When you said it will be sad and it will be challenging, it was literally emotionally and physically heartbreaking. And I felt very lonely. But now I understand that my parents are just human and they did the best with what they knew and what they could. And I have so much compassion and understanding and love. And I spend so much time with little me now. So whenever I'm feeling something and something just doesn't feel, and I feel like I'm overriding little me and just, quote, getting on with it and just being busy and just pushing harder, I now stop and just connect with little me and say, hey, sweetheart, I'm here. What do you need? How do you feel? And the simple act of just stopping and checking in with little me is reparenting, and that's everything in recovery. And then of course, taking the steps to recover and doing the body image work, which is deep work, but it's surface level stuff compared to this work. All of it together creates true lasting healing, but it's a heck of a journey. I've heard of, and I'm curious about your thoughts on this because I really disagree with this. I've heard of a therapy that's called something like rapid resolution therapy. It's a new thing. And apparently you can heal all of your trauma in one session without even feeling what you felt back then. How?
Yeah, so interesting, isn't it? I think the rapid resolution therapy is some probably kind of type of hypnotherapy, maybe, is it? Or I don't know.
It's all combined. And it's from a source that I trust, a girl called Manifestation Babe, Catherine Zinkina. I'm not saying I'm right in this because I don't know, but my intuition is almost, maybe it's just because I'm choosing to still have to suffer in order to heal. I don't know.
Yeah. I think like most things, there's probably nuance in there, isn't there? Like, I'm sure if you and I had a session of rapid resolution therapy, it may have been massively helpful as another tool along the journey. And it might have provided some insight and a bit of a breakthrough. I think this work is process stuff, isn't it? The stuff that we experience as little children, it takes years, doesn't it? We're like little sponges absorbing it all. And if you've had that drip, drip, drip of not good enough, sadly, you can't just flick a switch overnight. I think there's value in all these methods, and you may be able to really catapult yourself forward to a new level. But it's ongoing work, isn't it? I think every day to really notice. I mean, I think you and I, you know, we've done a lot of work on ourselves, haven't we? But I know myself, there's still things in my life that might trigger the I'm not good enough to this day. And like you say, you have to kind of reparent myself, tune in with myself, be very compassionate to myself and realize, of course, that's why that's coming up for you, because that's your vulnerable spot. What is it that you need right now? And so you can respond to it in a very different way, can't you? It's not like a miracle pill, is there?
That is the work. I'm so grateful to be on this journey, because I say I'm fully recovered, I am, but it doesn't mean the work, it never stops. Oh, like I notice within my business and the way I support my clients, I have to be really careful. I'm not allowing my clients and myself to create a codependent relationship with me and my clients, because that's all I've ever known growing up with my mom. There's a part of me that I'm working on with my coach now that likes to be needed, because I'm so of service and that's who I am. But there's a part of that that's actually a bit of a trauma bond, to want to be needed and to be able to help people so much in the way I do. Where do you draw the line between codependency and empowering the client? So that's what I'm currently working on. So noticing a little bit of people pleasing that's left, and a little bit of codependency that I'm creating with my clients. So I don't know if you feel comfortable sharing, if you're working on anything within your personal and spiritual journey.
I guess it's multiple things, isn't it, really? The people-pleasing part is something I still have to really work on. And I think the way I manage that sometimes as well is I'm super boundaried and I'm very protective of my time and energy. But sometimes I think I'm trying to navigate that path between that nice balance, in a way, of not protecting myself too much because of, I think I was such a people pleaser, but now in a way I've become very self-validating and almost much more detached. And yes, but maybe now I've gone a bit more the other way. So that's what I'm working on as well, to try and find that sweet spot of real deep connection and authenticity in relationships, but not being too pleasing or not being too detached. And that's an ongoing journey, isn't it? To kind of really just to nail that, really. Perhaps a bit like you, I feel things so deeply and I'm very emotionally driven person in a way. So I have to protect myself a lot from that in terms of what I let in as well, because of I have the tendency to take the responsibility of the world on my shoulders. So I'm quite ruthless about where I let my energy out now, I guess, really, and what I let in. But I have to be quite protective with that. So I think that's an ongoing journey.
That's beautiful, yeah. That everything's a pendulum swing, I guess, like the way of life. And then when we just naturally allow it to find its own balance, it's almost like when you were sharing that, I'm almost like, well, of course you've gone the other way, because if it was so far one way and now you have self-love and you want to protect yourself, of course it's going to go the other way slightly. So I still probably need to go more the way you are and then find, I think I'm still leaning towards still pleasing, but it's something I'm working on. I'm definitely getting better at it. It's a journey. I think we've gone through everything we wanted to chat about, but is there anything that we've not said that you want to share, Harriet?
No. I always say no and then I say yes.
Yeah, I'm also thinking actually.
I think I just want to kind of end on giving hope to people. I feel sometimes I'm quite a long way along the recovery journey, and a lot of people that are reaching out to me are like really in the trenches, and they kind of look at you as this recovered person, don't they? And they think, oh my God, I'm never going to get there, or you're just different from me, or you're more resourceful, you're more resilient. But I suppose I just really want to say, like, I have been in those trenches of genuinely just like having no sense of self and really chronic low self-esteem, really poor emotional regulation, just feeling so unworthy, I guess, and unlovable. And I think it has been a journey, but today I really do feel a great sense of peace. And I don't compare myself with other people. I really feel I'm very aligned with my mission and my purpose. I guess I just want to say to everyone listening and watching that that is possible for you. Your journey will be very, very different from mine and from yours. But actually, you were not put on this planet to like lose weight and be thin and be controlled by food. You have your things within you, and you probably know what they are when you really reflect. You're here to do something, to bring yourself meaning and purpose and joy and connect with others. So I guess I just really want to say to people, like, that is possible for you too, because I think people sometimes don't believe that.
Yeah, thank you so much for sharing that, Harriet, because I felt exactly as you felt, unlovable, unworthy, no sense of self. I had to ask my mom everything. Before I bought a pair of knickers, I had to send her a picture and be like, what? I'm not joking. Before I broke up with a boyfriend, I had to literally ask what she thought. So I couldn't trust myself even for decisions such as what underwear I'm going to buy. And people look at me now and see this when I say the word successful, whatever that means to the person, but I have time freedom, financial freedom. I'm living my passion and purpose. I'm a very strong, driven woman. And people look at me and they only see who I am today. And I share as much as possible about who I was to reflect just back what you said, Harriet. Every single person can recover, no matter what they've been through. It might just take a bit more time and we might go left and right as we continue to go progress upwards. But every single person can recover. And it's just about taking that first step. And one of my coaches said to me, and you would have heard this similar before, but the way he said it was just so cool. He said, all you have to do is follow the first breadcrumb. You follow the first breadcrumb, you get the second breadcrumb, etc. Then you'll find a loaf of bread. And you keep following the loaves of bread, and then you find your bakery. And I am in my bakery right now, and so are you, Harriet. And Currently, I don't want a factory. I'm quite happy with this bakery where I'm at. But if my heart leads me to find another bakery, then I will. So I think it's coming right back to this present moment right now and now and now. And this will get boring. Like, in this moment now, that's all we have. What do you want? How do you feel? Be with little you, and then take the action towards what you want. Because like Harriet says, there's more to life than trying to be thin, staying thin, and trying to be good enough in the eyes of others. Because like we said towards the beginning of this episode, you're already good enough. Start acting like it, and then you will feel it. Amen.
Yeah.
Well, this has been wonderful, Harriet. I was laughing at the start because I was very abrupt at the start, wasn't I? I was like,
I didn't notice that.
At the start, I was like, right, we're going to talk about this, this, and this. Go. So sorry for the abrupt start if anyone else also thought it was abrupt. But thank you, Harriet, for agreeing to have this conversation with me. And I hope it helps so many people.
Yeah, thanks so much for having me, Victoria. Yeah, thank you.
Much love to all our listeners and watchers. Bye.
So I hope you enjoyed this conversation just as much as I did. Do go and check out Victoria's details in the show notes. If you're not following me already on Instagram, do seek me out, the Eating Disorder Therapist _. And for further support with your relationship with food, do go to theeatingdisordertherapist.co.uk. If you're a professional listening, you might be interested in my eating disorders and body image online training courses. Also, if you're struggling with eating yourself, you may be interested in my Breaking Free from Bulimia course and my 10 steps to intuitive eating, all online at your own pace. Links are in the show notes. Thank you so much for listening. And if you enjoy this podcast, I'd be so grateful if you'd follow, rate, and review, as it helped it reach so many more listeners. Thank you so much for listening. And I look forward to sharing another podcast episode with you very soon.